You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme, I'm joined by guests Robert Fox and Sebastian Borger to discuss the day's top news stories. We'll look at Sweden's refugee crisis as the government announces plans to deport half of those who've recently arrived. Then we'll turn to the source of the crisis in Syria and ask if upcoming peace talks in Geneva are doomed to fail. All that plus the pros and cons of the International Criminal Court, the political circus descending on Iowa, and the winners and losers in a new ranking of global corruption. That's all on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. So, welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Sebastian Borger and Robert Fox. Sebastian is London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, and Robert is a defence editor at London's Evening Standard. Sebastian and Robert, welcome to you both. We'll begin today's programme in Sweden, where the Interior Minister has announced that the applications of at least 60,000 of the more than 150,000 migrants who sought asylum in the country would be rejected and would have to leave the country. Sweden accepted 90% of Syrian asylum applicants who entered the country last year. The government has now said there's a significant risk that many asylum seekers will stay in the country without papers. And Sebastian Borger, if you're going to have an asylum system and people who are refugees are going to be allowed to stay, then you also have to have a system where you accept that some people aren't going to succeed in their application, and you then have to make sure they leave.
I find the whole thing rather baffling. I don't quite understand the difference between a refugee and an asylum seeker. And a refugee is someone who seeks asylum. Mm. Now, you check on the border, or preferably on the border, or if that's not possible, inside the country, whether the claim has any merit. And you do that on an individual basis.
Do you find baffling about this case then?
Well, this guy telling us, the Swedish Interior Minister telling us that there will be a certain number of rejections. How does he know that? You know, I want the system. Well, I would expect the system to check individually and throw all those out whose claim has no merits.
Robert, this is one of those things which often looks, well, sometimes looks sensible on paper that you have this system, but the way it works, it doesn't necessarily always tally with that.
The way it looks in broadcast and on paper is a prime piece of political grandstanding. He has more or less admitted in his statement that he really can't do as much as he seems to be promising. He admits that of those that came last year, a considerable number who were rejected then went underground. This is what happens. I was listening to the UK's foreign minister, Philip Hammond, yesterday, had a big audience with a whole group of hacks like myself, promoted by Prospect magazine. He was trying to be Mr. Reasonable. Very interesting, very similar to this. The bottom line for EU negotiations was asylum and migration. And it sounded exactly the same style of rhetoric. But then comes the question, as you say, how? The figures projected in Sweden is that up to 80,000 could be sent. They're not going to be sent home because a very, very large number of them are from very remote parts of Afghanistan. And I don't see the Swedish Air Force going into the more remote parts of Faria province or whatever. And this is now building a head of steam, as we have discussed on this very programme over the months, that you have got a chemical reaction, as it were, with a lot of migrants. I take Sebastian's point, absolutely, you know, that who knows what they are, but about 750,000 between Greece and the Balkans. The Italians are reporting picking up about 4,000 from the sea, from the Gulf of Sirte alone per week. Every prospect that, as far as I can see, from the borders of Turkey, from the camps in Lebanon and Jordan, we're looking at a very similar flow, of which, by the way, only about 40-50% will be from Syria and the Levant. It's what is so extraordinary about this is we always seem to be two jumps behind the curve. And I'm very interested in the pronouncement of the Swedish Interior Minister. But the wish is the father of the thought, and it's going to be very, very difficult to execute that thought.
We'll come on to how you execute that thought in a moment. But Sebastian, I'm always, to use your word, baffled by the idea that anyone can get as far as Sweden without having already have been decided whether they are a refugee or not. Because wasn't Europe supposed to have this continent-wide system where you claim asylum at the first country that you enter, and that there'll be this very straightforward system of dispersing people across the EU?
Unless you get on a plane or a ship that docks Stockholm or any other place in Sweden itself, then that is quite right. Of course, the Dublin rules, that are the rules that you're referring to, have broken down entirely. I mean, because the southern European countries, particularly Italy and Greece, weren't able to or weren't willing to enforce them. And secondly, then, because Angela Merkel basically said, well, she didn't, of course, say Dublin isn't in force anymore, but she said things which made sure that Dublin wasn't in force anymore.
On this issue, then, Robert, how can the Swedish Interior Minister be so clear, almost, in a sense of saying this number of people will be sent back? How can they, if you've got a system where actually, if anyone is a refugee, is in need of seeking asylum in a country, you're not allowed to send them back from whence they came?
That is international law. And as Sebastian was saying, there is the Dublin principles, which came in, I think, around the 90s and then were reinforced. And now they're honoured in the breach. Countries like the UK, which is not very helpful at all in all this, are desperate for Dublin to be reimposed. But the EU is behaving in such a way that it is going through a real existential spasm now because of trying to say that, you know, that Greece should prevent migrants going from an EU country into a non-EU country, as it is at the moment. This is one of the ironies on the Macedonian border. It is breaking down entirely in practical terms in two aspects. Rightly, we focused on the Dublin Protocol, which people are hanging on to very desperately. And I'd just like to endorse something that he said very, very firmly. He talked about Greece, but he talked about Italy as well, which I am involved with quite a lot. The Italian approach, because this hasn't just come up with Syria, have been the recipient of migrants for two or three decades, since I really studied this when I was writing a book about the Mediterranean. The approach is just to shovel it on, that they have been loading people on trains. There has been the deliberate avoidance of documentation and fingerprinting in order to push people through. It is really a kind of judicial anarchy we're looking at the moment. And this is where Europe is trying to say, no, we've got to get tough, we've got to use hard security, building walls, literally, it seems, in the case of Macedonia and Greece. But the system is broken. Schengen has gone. The frontierless interior, that is called in question. And with this desperate appeal to go back, to impose or make the Dublin Protocol work and imposing the burden on the countries least capable of doing it, and I'm afraid I do include Italy in that as well as Greece. Am I giving you an impression of a piece of geopolitics that's written by Lewis Carroll? It really is, and it is very worrying because fine words butter no parsnips, as they say in the UK. the rhetoric from individual nations and collectively from the EU seems so at right angles to reality that I think we have a real crisis and it is just weeks, possibly at the most months away.
Sebastian, to go back to this issue of deportations, how does Sweden even begin to do this?
Aha. Uh-huh.
The nice, easy question for
can
you.
Can I first of all say, I mean, it's all very well for Robert to slag off the EU, and everybody does that, and so do the Germans. The stance of the UK government is entirely shameful.
I am not a spokesman for the UK.
No, I understand that. But what I'm saying is, these countries, Sweden, Germany, and the like, have been totally left in the lurch.
Absolutely.
By countries like Denmark, by countries like Hungary, etc., in the central and eastern of Europe. So
if you deport people
in any country, whether that's Sweden or anybody anywhere else, by having clear documentation, by knowing who you've got in your country, and by then enforcing the rules. And if you can't do that, then you have a problem with your own population. Yep. That's what we're seeing in Sweden.
That's what we're seeing in Germany.
Yep. Even in Germany. Yep. Even in rule-based Germany. And in that sense, while I'm very unhappy about the way the debate here in Britain is, constantly talking about a European problem. Well, you know, Britain is part of Europe, and a lot of these people would like to be in Britain. And in fact, of course, we all know that we've got about 500,000 illegals in London alone. So let's not tell the British authorities this is not the point of my argument either.
But on the issue, though, of, you know, because I'm interested to hear from both of you, sort of, how do you actually start any sort of deportation process here, Robert?
It is very difficult indeed, and that is the point. And I could not agree more. Britain is a medium to global power, behaving in a very small-minded way. What I do fear is that Sweden's interior minister was saying, it's moving a lot of people. And moving a lot of people is a very big logistical problem. Now, collective memory is important here because an awful lot of people moved the ingathering from the eastern lands of up to 10 million Germans and so on. But remember what Europe looked like in those days. And it was a difficult process. You had DPs, DP camps, that's displaced persons. But you had a Europe which was under arms. Where I think, again, where you can criticise Britain, particularly with this government of Cameron, has no sense of public agency that should be involved in this and is under treaty and allied obligations. I mean, these countries, as Sebastian says rightly, like Sweden, like Germany and Italy and Greece, are our friends and fundamental allies. You wouldn't believe it to listen to quite a bit of the rhetoric in the House of Commons at the moment. But this is where I am critical of the EU leadership, because I think it's the banging heads together at the time. It can only be done by collective solidarity, and it is a European problem. And that, I think, is what the crisis will come to in the next few weeks, because it isn't just Sweden alone, it isn't just Germany alone, and certainly it cannot just be Greece and Italy alone.
Okay, we got sidetracked a little bit. Let's go back to the original question. How do you deport people?
Well, you deport people in every country. I think
tens of thousands.
How do you deport tens of thousands of people?
It is very difficult.
That's why I'm struggling to understand sort of how any government in anywhere in Europe is going to be able to do this.
I'm not saying it's impossible.
You're not now asking a German to outline a plan for that. But please, if you want me to, you have to have detention centres.
Yes.
You have to take people. You have to obviously treat them well. You feed them well. But you then send them back to where they came from. Sorry.
But this is the thing then. Is Europe prepared to do that? Can it do it in a way that is that actually does treat people with respect. Because let's face it, to go back to Britain again, the way Britain treats people that it deports is appalling.
Absolutely. And but I agree that I think that you just cannot allow things like the jungle to persist in Calais. You are going to have transit centres, detention centres, yes, they will be, and you are going to have to put refugees in camps like the DP situation, but in modern times, it is going to be very tough love. This is where we are in a different situation from the late 1940s in Europe, because of course the power that will push against it is the human rights lobby, which is extremely powerful. Sorry, I'm not making a moral prescription. Fact, it will happen. Courts will be consumed with this business. It is very difficult. But this is why I think there's a fundamental behind this, and I haven't gone off the point, I hope you will grant me this. I'm going behind the point now. This is not temporary, this condition. There is something happening in world geopolitics which quite a few people, including myself, have written about this for year after year after year. I have been called into government seminars. I've been called into international seminars. But the government, they have very, very little grasp of a geopolitical strategy, human geography, because their life as politicians is quotidian, which means daily, but actually they don't really think much in terms of the vote beyond a fortnight or a month. And this is a long problem which their successor governments are going to have to grasp. What I find, you know, in the strategic studies area is that there is very little appreciation. This is way up the agenda now. It's item number 2, 3 or whatever. Actually, you can ask some quite serious, thoughtful generals in the army and the armies of Europe. By golly, they're thinking about it.
Okay, I'm afraid we're going to have to move on to Geneva now, where peace talks on the war in Syria are due to begin before the end of the week, although it's still unclear, A, if they're going to begin, B, who's actually going to turn up. Sebastian, it's a little bit like when you're invited to a party and you kind of want to find out who else is going before you go. It's like, oh, are they going? Okay, well, maybe I will. It's a bit of a mess, isn't it?
It's more like a torture party, isn't it? I mean, at a normal party, you hope for a goodie bag. There won't be any goodie bags in this negotiation. I can fully understand why the Syrian opposition is very reluctant to take part. We've heard about the apparent initiative by President Putin to try and get Assad to resign voluntarily. Do we believe that or not? You know, it is a cloak and daggers as usual from Moscow, but he is clearly not in any way interested in that. Apart from whether we got the opposition around the table or not, where will it lead to? Are we coming round to the moment where we have to say there'll be a long-term solution, but in the medium term, Assad stays in place?
This seems to be a fundamental problem, Robert, doesn't it? And that if you look at successful peace talks, whether that is Northern Ireland, whether that is, you know, we certainly hope the situation with Colombia and the FARC, there was a sort of, even before the talks began, there was a pretty decent outline of where it might end, that something that could just about be acceptable to everyone. You could sort of trace something. Here, I mean, it's impossible.
Yeah, the facts on the ground are really ominous, and I follow exactly what Sebastian has said, that it's appalling, because what you have to ask yourself in how wars begin, it's much easier to identify how wars begin than how they end, because they're ragged, they're not as formal as they ever were, if they ever were formal, but, you know, when you had state armies and state powers involved, the fighting option has not been exhausted by too many interested parties on the ground, and that is the grimness of it. Brilliant depiction of Russia and Assad, as of, I thought Assad might be parlayed out of it. Since what has been happening in Alawitistan, that they've been carving out this enclave, which was always an option north of Latakia, where the Alawites could go hard in their stronghold, which they will. By that I mean the associated linked clans of the Assad family and others. The Russians, I think, despite these reports, a scoop by the FT saying that a Russian general persuaded Assad that just before Christmas that he would have to go eventually, that's all off now.
And a few by days later, the general was dead.
Yes, yeah, and exactly. And by the way, don't think it's just to do with Alawites or an individual. We're being much too simplistic about it. It's a group of very hard Baathist, convinced, actually it is an ideology, Palestinians around the cupola, the dome, of the Assad power elite. And you cannot have the Baathist administration, a sort of rump Baathist administration, the dream perhaps that they aspired to with Chalabi in Iraq in 2003, without the Assads. We are not looking at the DNA of human history and of human facts on the ground. And I think that this is very worrying. And I'm not meaning to bang on the urgency behind the Geneva talks is that nobody is getting to grips with ISIL. Yes, they're pegging them back. They're doing this, that, and the other. There is the Italians particularly are shrieking about it. The Americans, the Obama team are telling you about it. We've got to do something quite soon about ISIL in the Maghreb because they're about to bust out of Libya and take Tunisia.
Sebastian, on that issue of ISIS, there have been some people that have said over the past few months that, look, when it comes to Syria, yeah, forget about Assad. Yes, he's bad. But look, the problem is ISIS. We need to concentrate on ISIS. Do you buy that argument?
I do.
I don't.
Why do you? And then we'll come on to why don't you.
I call them Daesh to start with, like our American friends. I think, as I said before, Syria is a complete mess. You cannot start off talks by saying, this guy who has clung on to power with his bloody hands for almost 5 years now has to go before anything else can happen. It's unrealistic. So you've got to give him some leeway. You've got to say, as I think I outlined, that there must be interim solutions, and at some stage then we hope he can leave the
But he's had 5 years of leeway.
No, he hasn't. He's been in a very bloody civil war for 5 years. This is what we're talking about is a something which resembles peace, at least a ceasefire, where the country can be rebuilt, and where other elites can come back and maybe hopefully find their own place in that society.
Robert, you don't agree.
Assad and the regime is toxic. It was an uber, sorry to use the kleptocracy. That's its reputation. And I understand your logic, Sebastian. It's absolutely right in the best of all possible worlds. But when you have criminality to that depth, and we are still seeing it going on with the siege, and the Russians are conniving at the sieges of the communities, there is no way for, even I think in the interim, that you could have an interim government ruling the whole of a disintegrated Syria with the Assad name on it. That has gone. And that is part of the problem, because you've got to focus on both of them. You've got to see if any of it is viable. But a hell of a lot of the army, I have to say, the bits of the army that really work, are personally loyal to the Assad clan, including Maher, his very, very tough cousin, who is a cousin or brother who commands the 4th Division, that you're not going to get, the curate's egg, we'll pick out the good bits. I think it's just going to be more difficult, Sebastian, than we've been saying here.
And Sebastian, on this other point about, you know, should we perhaps side with Assad in the fight against ISIS, what message would that be saying to the opposition groups inside Syria that want to get rid of Assad? Essentially, that's saying you guys should probably side with ISIS because that's the best way you've got to get rid of Assad.
Well, you wouldn't side with him. You wouldn't give them any of that kind of message, apart from that they aren't terribly keen on ISIL stroke Daesh either. Look, I mean, it's not, if any situation has ever been shades of grey, then this is it. And I agree, but I mean, it's interesting for the Americans to shout about Tunisia and Libya, etc. Well, they should really get more involved then.
Well, indeed, if the Americans stop caring about Libya at the moment that they left Benghazi.
Well, there's an awful row about in Congress going on about it. We park that, but I agree with you, and it is. I don't think it's just the Americans. I do blame countries like my own for this, because they keep on harking back to, you know, no intervention. Look at the ghastliness of Afghanistan and Iraq, and yet they're prosecuting campaigns which are, in terms of mistaken tactics, they're almost criminally stupid. The fact that you think you can contain ISIL, ISIS, Daesh within its region by bombing alone. But, you know, every other Thursday fortnight do we have our own revered prime minister in this country say, no boots on the ground, goes on the BBC. The BBC, so they mission creep, boots on the ground. All these thundering cliches, which are absolutely meaningless in this context. I fear we're in for a lot worse, because we're talking about, you know, how difficult, how tricky Putin is. Well, one of the big news of last week is, of course, the contraction of the Russian economy. I don't think Russia can keep this going, the support of Assad, to the level of which they're doing, for very much longer. I give it a year at most.
If we end up talking about the Russian economy, we are going to be here all night. I want to move on to at least one of the other topics we were going to talk about. We've got the Iowa caucuses coming up very, very soon. Coverage you'll be able to hear on Monocle 24 over the coming days. Thomas Lewis is there for us reporting over the next few days. Sebastian Borger, there's something a little bit strange, isn't there, about Iowa being playing such an important role in who the next president of the US is going to be, and particularly when, you know, you look at the Republican campaign and it seems like it's a choice between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz.
You want me to talk about Donald Trump? I'm on Donald Trump strike.
You don't have to talk about Mr. Trump. You don't have to at all.
I think, you know, we're all gone completely mad. If they are anywhere near as mad as actually nominating the guy, then the American public, who I have great trust in, will tell the Republican Party where to go. So seriously, let's not. Iowa? Why Iowa? I mean, one of those completely mad things that they all have to like ethanol, which has been discredited as a form of energy for about 15 years now, but we're still going on about it. Madness.
And Robert Fox, there is an element to Trump which is interesting to you, and that's the sort of this schism between Donald Trump and Fox News, Roger Ailes, and Rupert Murdoch.
I think I'm rather different from Sebastian. I believe in the cock-up theory of history rather than conspiracy. And I think the great symptom of the great cock-up, I hope he sues me, is Donald Trump. Is how you end up with this. You can hear really the mad echoes, and I do love language. I do love language when it means absolutely nothing. When you get the endorsement of Sarah Palin, where I actually thought she was talking through a scrambler, but he does strike a chord, and there is some serious politics about it, not necessarily the politics of the caucus. The fight between Donald Trump and Fox News, and he is really up to something. He is trying to dislodge Fox News, which is easily the most popular, I understand, God knows why, coast-to-coast news station in the US. I mean, there's method in his madness about things like this, and it's really rather nasty and sinister, naming what interlocutors from whatever channel will interview him. I do agree with Sebastian. I mean, it is inconceivable that such a clownish figure really will get to the top. But the
is it inconceivable?
Well, it is not inconceivable.
Top, I mean, as in win the nomination.
But because by this clownishness, he makes really serious candidates like Hillary Clinton, whatever else you say about her, she is a serious candidate with a serious record. He makes her look dull.
Well, there we are. On that note, that was Midori House. It was anything but dull. My thanks to Sebastian Borger and to Robert Fox. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Yasmin Omar. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Carlotta Ribello is here next, and it's Andrew with The Urbanist. We're back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 in London, 1300 in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.